Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. School suspensions have risen in recent years in many parts of the country, a trend that threatens long-running efforts to reform school discipline and develop restorative justice strategies centered on children's mental health, and which has prompted new worries over widespread and persistent racial disparities in how schools punish kids. We'll hear more about that later in the show. But first, the Trump administration has imposed drastic restrictions on information and communications from a number of federal agencies and the Department of Health and Human Services, including, among others, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, the Centers for Disease Control, the Food and Drug Administration, and the National Institutes of Health, which, by the way, includes the National Institute on Drug Abuse. I must clarify that thankfully the FDA is still being allowed to release urgent communications like company warning letters, drug safety alerts, and food recalls. This so-called guidance was imposed with immediate effect, so abruptly, in fact, that an event for early career researchers to learn about NIH and grant making and its research funding was canceled in the middle of a presentation. A copy of the memo was obtained by a journalist with thehandbasket.co. According to it, all sponsored travel for HHS personnel is immediately frozen. All future requests are not authorized and should not be approved. The guidance is so broad and controlling that all public presentations at conferences or meetings must now be cleared beforehand by a presidential appointee, not just their supervisor or another agency official, a presidential appointee. According to the memo, this is in effect until further notice, so it's indefinite as well as immediate. Oh, but wait, there's more. At the time of this recording, the White House website no longer has sections or pages devoted to the Office of National Drug Control Policy, same for the Office of Gun Violence Prevention. The links return a 404 not found in the latter case, and in the case of ONDCP, a redirect to the White House homepage. If I were pressed, I'd guess that the redirect may be a sign that the White House plans to keep ONDCP around for the time being, or at least that they haven't decided yet whether or not to dump it. Now, loyal listeners know that for a long time, I've complained about the quality as well as the dumbing down of publications, the paucity of data, and the politicization of research by agencies like NIDA, SAMHSA, and the Bureau of Justice Statistics. I mentioned BJS. BJS is, of course, under the Department of Justice and wasn't included in this new gag order. That wasn't needed. They didn't have to. BJS got muzzled decades ago by a provision of the Patriot Act. I mean, they'll still face cuts, but that'll be down the line in the next budget. This is a developing story, and admittedly, I'm a data nerd, but this affects all of us. So we'll continue to cover this and bring you more news when it happens. Keep tuning in. This is Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. From the unfolding crisis that's our current federal government, we turn to the state of Oregon's ongoing public defense crisis. First, let's get an overview of the crisis and some history to learn how we got here. Jessica Camphe is executive director of the Oregon Public Defense Commission. She testified January 23rd at an informational hearing in a joint meeting of the Oregon Legislature's House and Senate Committees on the Judiciary.
My name is Jessica Camphe, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Public Defense Commission. Thank you for inviting us here today. I am here to provide this committee with an introduction and overview to OPDC and the public defense system. I see our PowerPoint is now up, so we're ready to go. My hope is to really just have a conversation with you all and to introduce us. And so if you have questions for me along the way, please do feel free to stop me as we go and ask them. We are a mission-driven agency, and we are every day working to fulfill our mission. What we are here today to talk to you all about really falls into four categories, talking about the history of public defense in Oregon to give you all some background, especially for new members, talking about Senate Bill 337 from the 2023 session, our public defense delivery system generally overview, the unrepresented persons crisis, as well as the future of public defense in Oregon. So we'll start with history. Oregon's public defense system really came into being, we started in 1955, but we really came into being in 1963 with the Supreme Court decision of Gideon versus Wainwright. And that is the decision that says that anybody accused of a crime is entitled to counsel. And so Oregon really sprung into action when that decision came out and first created the right to counsel and public defense in Oregon in 1963. Then there was a big shift in 1983 when the state took over the right to counsel for our contracted attorneys, and that's really when our appellate division came into being. And then not a whole lot happened for a while until 2001, and that is when the legislature merged trial-level public defense and the appellate public defense and created the agency that we have grown into be today. And things were pretty quiet for a while until 2019. In 2018, the legislature became aware of emerging problems in public defense and commissioned a study that's called the Sixth Amendment Study. That study comes out in 2019 and is really a catalyst for a lot of the reform work that has happened in Oregon and public defense over the past 6 years. So in 2020, there was a bill brought forward to reform public defense that ultimately died. In 2021, the agency adopted a new way of providing public defense, moving away from an old model to an FTE system. And we also had a House bill that created the baseline reforms that we then built upon in 2023. And so just kind of give you an overview of some history on public defense in Oregon. As I stated earlier, in 2018, the legislature was becoming aware of the issues that existed in public defense, and at that time, they created legislation that directed the agency to go out and get a study. And the purpose of that study was to identify Oregon-specific caseload standards and an assessment of Oregon's public defense system. So that legislatively directed study comes to culmination in 2019 with the Sixth Amendment Center report. This ends up being a really important report for public defense. And so in this report, they identify really four main problems that are happening in public defense. The first one is that the state has a complex bureaucracy that lacked sufficient oversight and financial accountability. The second is that the fixed fee case model was a conflict of interest because it pitted the financial interests of the lawyers against the interests in their clients having their cases fully litigated. The third was that the composition of the Public Defense Services Commission, which was our governing body at that time, didn't adhere to national best practices. And then the fourth had to do with municipal courts. I put this up here as a reference document because we've done so much work in these areas and we've so much improvement. So when we talk about the lacking oversight and financial accountability, back in 2019, the state could not tell you which lawyers were assigned on which cases, working under which contracts, and whether or not they were qualified to handle those cases. We just didn't know. And if you look at where we are at today, as opposed to where we were then now, we have so much more information about the people that are doing public defense work in the state, what contracts they're working under, what their caseloads are looking like, whether or not they're qualified to handle the types of cases they're being appointed to. So that's been an area of huge growth and improvement for the agency. The fixed fee case model, we're going to talk more about that. That is something that the agency took an initial stab at addressing in 2022 when they first adopted a maximum attorney caseload model, which is something that's commonly called MAC. The third component of this, the composition of the public defense services system, this is something the legislature fixed with Senate Bill 337, and they did two really big things here. One, they changed the composition of our commission. So it used to just be that the Chief Justice appointed all of our commissioners, and they served at her pleasure. And now the composition of our commission is much more diverse. It represents the legislature, it represents the governor's office, it represents the judicial branch, as well as represents the community. So a lot of work went into making sure that our commission was a more representative oversight body. And we moved from the judicial branch of government to the executive branch of government, where we landed on the first of this month. So that's a really big accomplishment. So a lot of the work that the Public Defense Services Commission has been doing these past 6 years really is rooted in this study. So it really is a foundational document. And we have a lot of wins. We've come a long way. I talked briefly about that maximum attorney caseload. So this was created in 2022 to really address the issue of fixed fee case credit model. And so the agency was looking to fix a problem that was first identified in that study. This is a transitional oversight tool, so it now allows us to know how many cases lawyers are working on and to ensure that they are not taking on so many cases that they can't provide adequate representation for their clients. The model is based on the 2021 Oregon study as well as Washington's annual caseload limits. And so it is a transitional tool. It is the tool that's in place right now for most of our contractors, but it's something that we are looking to transition away from as we move more towards a timekeeping model in the future. The Oregon Public Defense Commission oversees the delivery of public defense in three main buckets. We've got our trial level public defenders. This is a new program that we stood up this year. We've got our contracted public defenders. We contract with 164 entities to provide public defense across the state. And then we have our hourly public defenders. This is a growing program that's in development. And we now have 269 lawyers that are working in that program. In terms of our contracted public defenders, they cover a whole lot of different case types, and they're broken down into really three categories. We've got nonprofit law firms, consortia of attorneys, and law firms, and those are the different entity types that we contract with. We have, and this is available on our website, and when we talked earlier about the work that we've been doing in oversight, we now have a lot of information about who's doing public defense in the state of Oregon, what cases they're assigned to, where they're working, what their qualifications are. We can also see how many new cases they've taken, how many cases they've closed, and what their open caseload looks like. So this is like just a huge win in our oversight area and our ability under our current system to provide oversight that we were not able to do back in 2019. This is available on our website and is interactive. Our state defenders, we are delivering defense through the state system in three areas. We have our appellate division. They've been around since 1963. Our juvenile appellate since 2008. And then just this past year in December of 2023, we opened our first offices for trial level public defense at the state level. Our state defenders, they opened this past year. We've got three offices that they have set up, and they've now taken over 1,100 cases in their first year. So that's really exciting news for us. There's been a lot of growth in that division over the past year. So we didn't start with all 20 lawyers. We didn't get all 20 lawyers until December of 2024. But we started with one lawyer, and we've gotten up to 20 over time. This is information that's also available on our website. So you can see where we're taking cases. We're all over the state. How many cases we've taken. Right now it's 1,166 cases that the trial level lawyers have taken. You can see what types of cases they're taking and in what offices they're taking them. We also have our hourly lawyers, and so we are doing hourly work within the agency in a couple of different ways. We have our standard hourly rates for lawyers. We have our temporary hourly increase program. This is a program the agency launched in order to address the unrepresented persons crisis, and it pays higher hourly rates for lawyers and investigators who accept appointment on cases where the person's in custody without a lawyer. We also do hourly work with all sorts of different vendors, investigators, interpreters, mental health, behavioral health. So we have a lot of hourly work that happens within the agency. You can see a breakdown of the types of hourly bills that we receive and pay out. And so you can really see where those hourly expenses are hitting us in terms of what categories are being paid out in the greatest amount. And our hourly program has been growing. So back in July of 2023, we were doing about 0.9 million every month, and now in attorney fee vouchers, and now we're doing 2.6 million in attorney fee vouchers every month. We started off doing about 2.2 million in non-attorney vouchers, and now we're doing 7.6 million in non-attorney vouchers every month. So this is an area of great growth. This is a program that's growing a lot within the agency. I want to touch on unrepresented persons. As I'm sure you all know, Oregon has been facing an unrepresented persons crisis for the past couple of years. This is data that is available from the Oregon Judicial Department that shows the unrepresented persons cases across Oregon. And so we can see that in terms of the in-custody unrepresented persons cases, that number has really stabilized, and it really started to stabilize in July of 2023 when the agency entered new contracts with our providers. But we are continuing to see growth in other areas, particularly in that out-of-custody population. A lot of that is because the agency's resources has been targeting getting counsel for the in-custody people who are the most vulnerable without lawyers, but that has meant that the out-of-custody has come in second in terms of priority. One of the programs that we are delivering lawyers to unrepresented persons is through that temporary hourly increased rate program. That program has been very successful in identifying a lot of lawyers for folks and getting counsel on cases. So we've provided representation on 7,600 cases through this program, serving more than 5,000 clients. And here is a breakdown of costs, so you can see if the money's going to pay investigator fees, attorney fees, or all other fees. That's things like psych, interpreters, those types of fees. We have also been working internally with our staff to identify counsel for people who are in custody and potentially subject to release under a Ninth Circuit case if they don't get a lawyer. So there was a Ninth Circuit case that came out that said if you don't get a lawyer within 7 days and you're in jail, you get released from custody. Our agency created a policy for how to prioritize those cases. We've got people working within our agency that their whole job is making sure that we're identifying counsel for those folks within the first 7 days. They've successfully identified counsel for 1,214 cases. So that's people that would have been released from custody if we hadn't gotten them a lawyer within that short time frame, and we were able to successfully get them counsel. Those cases are being represented by folks under our contracts, by hourly folks, mm-hmm. as well as by our trial division. And the state trial division has been a really important backstop in preventing those releases, because they're the people that on day six, if there isn't a lawyer, they're taking those cases and they're going all around the state to provide that representation. You can see in the chart where we're providing representation around the state, as well as on what types of cases. And these are all our tier one cases. You may be surprised to see so many misdemeanors in tier one, but that's because we consider domestic violence to be a tier one offense, and many of those charges are misdemeanor charges. In terms of the future of public defense, where are we going? Well, we've got a timeline coming up with Senate Bill 337. So that timeline says that in this next biennium, 2025-2027, public defense will be provided by our state employees, by nonprofit law firms under contract, by consortia and private bar attorneys under contract, and by lawyers paid at an hourly rate. In 2027, our consortia and private bar transitions from that contract model to a panel of qualified hourly counsel model. And then we will continue to grow the state employment. And so we've got 2031, 20% of public defense by state employees, and 2035, 30%. The next big thing on the horizon for public defense is really timekeeping. So as we get the infrastructure through our financial and case management system, we are working towards a system that provides added oversight for public defense through a timekeeping model. And so that is sort of quickly approaching on the horizon.
That was Jessica Camphie, Executive Director of the Oregon Public Defense Commission, testifying January 23rd about Oregon's public defense crisis at an informational hearing in a joint meeting of the Oregon Legislature's House and Senate Committees on the Judiciary. Now, I've got her presentation in front of me, and frankly, the really interesting data aren't made any clearer on her slides. So, here are some numbers from the Oregon Public Defense Commission's Unrepresented Individuals Dashboard. Quote, as of January 24th, 2025, there are 3,891 unrepresented individuals and 1,698 individuals who were previously unrepresented but did not appear in court and are now in warrant status. These individuals will not be prioritized for an attorney appointment until they clear the warrant and appear in court again. End quote. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's turn now to another crisis that's unfolding in schools across the country. School suspensions have risen in many parts of the country in recent years. This trend threatens long-running efforts to reform school discipline and to develop restorative justice strategies centered on children's mental health. It's also prompted new worries over widespread and persistent racial disparities in how schools punish kids. In Missouri, for example, black students served 36% of all days in suspension, despite making up only 15% of the student body. There are gender gaps as well. Black girls had the highest rates of exclusionary discipline in public schools. Autistic students and students with mental health issues are more likely to be suspended. Many schools are also struggling with persistent staff shortages, particularly special education specialists, aides, and resource staff. These schools are less able to intervene and to help support children in crisis. Instead, they're more likely to have higher suspension rates. Rachel M. Pereira, Ph.D., is a fellow in the Governance Studies Program for the Brown Center on Education Policy at Brookings, whose research examines how racial and socioeconomic inequalities develop in K-12 education and the consequences of policies designed to help reduce educational inequality. She took part recently in a webinar hosted by the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism entitled Suspended, Student Mental Health and Unequal Discipline.
Suspension rates have been increasing steadily for decades. They've tapered off over the last decade or so, but we saw really marked increases between 1973 and 2010. We see that racial disparities in suspensions, particularly for Black students, have always existed, and that as suspension rates increase, racial disparities widened. And while these data are only showing suspension rates by race and ethnicity, we know that there are also very stark inequalities based on gender and disability status. And when we consider these aspects of student identity together, we know, for example, that Black boys with disabilities have some of the highest suspension rates on record. And so, you know, when we're talking about suspensions and discipline, it's really important to take that intersectional lens. Now, if you're asking yourself, why did suspension rates increase? There's a lot to this story, and I could spend a lot of time trying to unpack the different factors and trends that have contributed to rises in suspensions and rises in inequality in suspensions. But I'm going to try and hit on just a couple that I think are important, again, for the broader context of this, what I think is a very pressing education policy problem. So one, we know from empirical research across many decades that as schools integrated racially and as they integrated students with disabilities, because keep in mind that students with disabilities by and large did not have access to public schools before the early 1970s. And so as schools integrated on these dimensions, suspension rates for those groups increased. You see really clear increases in suspensions as desegregation is taking place. And what's worse, research shows that those increases in suspension gaps were durable. So they didn't close, you know, 4 or 5 years later. And so, you know, another way that education scholars think about this is as second generation segregation. So as schools became integrated, schools found ways of segregating students internally through tracking and through discipline policy that was disproportionately affecting racially minoritized students. We also know that as the school system integrated, the Black educator workforce was decimated. And we know from a lot of empirical research that Black kids, for example, are far less likely to be suspended when they are taught by Black teachers when they are in school systems and schools that have Black school leaders. In the 1980s and 1990s, we know that things like the war on drugs, the proliferance of zero tolerance policies in both the criminal justice system, but also in the school system, had huge implications for how school level discipline policy changed, and in ways that led to increases in zero tolerance policies, which, you know, for those who may be new to thinking about these problems, zero tolerance policies is this sort of idea that if we are, you know, we apply harsh punishments to even trivial infractions, we can try to deter kids from misbehaving in more serious ways. And what we know from the research is that these types of zero tolerance policies that proliferated in the 1990s, in part because of some legislation during the Clinton administration, the 1994 Gun-Free Schools Act is really important to this story. We again saw really sharp increases in suspension rates and expulsions. Now, over the last, I'd say, 15 years or so, we've started to see a shift in the discipline policy landscape that I think is really consequential for thinking about some of the challenges today. There's a growing consensus in the education research community that suspensions don't work. They're not effective at any of their stated goals, and they have harmful short and long-term consequences, and in racially disparate ways. We know that they exacerbate inequality. And so what you start to see around 2010 is states and school districts start to change their school discipline policy to put limits on the use of suspensions and promote alternative, less punitive approaches like restorative justice programs. LAUSD was one of the sort of early adopters of these policies. California was the first state to make statewide policy change. We also saw federal guidance during the second Obama term, where there was an effort to reinvigorate federal civil rights enforcement to remedy racial discrimination. And so there's been this sort of wave of policy action over the last 10, 15 years. But now I think we're at an inflection point where the pandemic has created acute challenges for schools, both in terms of student need and in terms of educator workforce shortages, educator burnout. And we're seeing reports of worsening student misbehavior, increasing suspension rates. All the while, some states and districts are still in the middle of trying to reform school discipline policy. And so it's having the effect, given that the implementation of these reforms has been uneven. We know that they've been successful in some places, but not all, that we are seeing some states like Nevada, Kentucky, Arizona roll back on those reform efforts because they're coming to the conclusion that the reform efforts aren't working. Although I would argue as a researcher, they're coming to those conclusions prematurely, given that they are trying to implement these changes during sort of acutely challenging moments without sufficient resources. But nonetheless, we're now seeing, I think, a bifurcation across states and localities where some places are really doubling down on these investments in alternative practices and others are returning to more punitive approaches. And so I think, you know, we're at a challenging moment in this space, but the broader sort of history and context is helpful to keep in mind as we're navigating these policy discussions.
That was Dr. Rachel M. Pereira, a fellow in the Governance Studies Program for the Brown Center on Education Policies at the Brookings Institution, speaking on a webinar hosted by the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism entitled Suspended, Student Mental Health and Unequal Discipline. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline is a volunteer production for community radio, syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's AudioPort service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. You'll also find a link there to subscribe to the Prison Pipeline podcast. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long.